Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Alice Bryant, Jill Robbins, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Miki Sakabwe is a fashion designer from Congo. She has trained in Rwanda, Burundi, and Kenya. She has never had the chance to show her work in Congo because of security issues. But that changed over the weekend. A handful of designers presented the first fashion show in the eastern Congo city of Beni in years. It was a welcome distraction for residents who have faced attacks by Allied Democratic Forces rebels and other armed groups. They have killed thousands of people over the past 3 years. Sakabwe said, "I am happy to be exhibiting my necklaces and clothes made with local products here in Beni, and I believe this will give hope to the people here." She and thousands of others in eastern Congo wonder when the violence will end. Earlier this month, the ADF attacked a local United Nations peacekeeping group. The attack killed 15 Tanzanian peacekeepers and 5 Congolese soldiers. It was the deadliest attack on a UN peacekeeping mission in nearly 25 years. Uganda and Congo have launched a joint military offensive against the rebels. Inonyi Bwanakawa is the mayor of Beni. He said he believes the city is becoming safer. "We would like to show the world that in Beni and in northeast Congo, there is life and tourists can come here," he said. Over the weekend, nearly 600 people attended the Beni fashion show. Some of the items on display were colored loincloths, masks, and traditional materials designed into modern styles. Rosalind Mbaya was the lead designer. She used Congolese fabrics mixed with flower designs and lace. Mbaya said some of the show's proceeds will go to women who have been raped by the ADF. She said the women need to feel they are still loved by society.
Vietnam has launched a new operation to fight what the government has called wrong views on the internet. The new cyber combat operation, Force 47, has 10,000 members. It is part of the government's growing effort to end criticism against the state. Lieutenant General Nguyen Chau Nia is one of the heads of the military's political department. At a Monday conference of the Central Propaganda Department, he said the operation is already at work in several areas of the government. "In every hour, minute, and second, we must be ready to fight proactively against the wrong views," he said. Communist-ruled Vietnam has increased attempts to control the internet. The government intends to watch social media more closely and remove material it believes is offensive. In August, Vietnam's president said the country needed to pay greater attention to controlling news websites and blogs with bad and dangerous material. Last month, a blogger was sent to jail for 7 years for spreading propaganda against the state. The blogger had written about a massive chemical waste spill made by Formosa, a Taiwanese-owned factory in Vietnam. The court also rejected an appeal from Met Nam, or Mother Mushroom, who is serving a 10-year jail sentence on anti-state propaganda. Met Nam had posted articles on Facebook critical of the government on human rights and civilian deaths in police custody. Vietnam is one of the top 10 countries for Facebook users. The government has written an internet security bill asking for local placement of Facebook and Google servers. But the bill has been the subject of fierce debate at the National Assembly and is still awaiting its approval. Its neighboring country, China, allows only local internet companies that operate under restricted rules. Cybersecurity firm FireEye Inc. said Vietnam had developed strong internet spying abilities in an area of the world with weak defenses. A representative of FireEye told Reuters news agency that Vietnam is not the only nation using these abilities. He said the growing use among nations will impact governments, journalists, activists, and even international companies. He said that cyber spying is becoming more attractive to nations, partly because it provides them with a lot of information while the costs are modest and risks are low. Vietnam denies these claims. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome back to Everyday Grammar from VOA Learning English. Today, we return to a very common verb form in English, phrasal verbs. You will find one phrasal verb in every 192 words of written English. They will make your English sound more natural once you begin using them correctly. In an earlier program, we explained how and why English speakers use them. Today, we look at some often used phrasal verbs. This type of phrasal verb allows a direct object to come between the verb and the preposition or adverb. As you will hear, there is a special rule that learners should know about when using these 10 phrasal verbs.
As you know, a phrasal verb is a phrase with two or more words, a verb and a preposition or adverb or both. We call the preposition or adverb a particle when it combines with a verb. Here are two examples.
Please put the lamp on the desk. I think you're putting me on.
In the first sentence, on is a preposition showing the position of the lamp. In the second sentence, on is an adverbial particle. Put on is a phrasal verb meaning fool or trick in this sentence.
An important point is that a regular verb plus preposition combination has two meanings. A phrasal verb, that is, a verb plus particle, has a single meaning within a sentence. Many phrasal verbs have a number of different meanings in different situations. Yet, the meaning of the verb plus particle can usually be expressed with a single Latin-based verb. Here are two sentences with the same meaning.
They tore down the old building. They demolished the old building.
The verb tear has its own meaning, and so does the preposition down. They can combine with other words when they are alone. But as a phrasal verb, tear down, they have one meaning, destroy. In 1987, U.S. President Ronald Reagan visited West Germany. He told a crowd in the divided city of Berlin,
"Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall."
Now for the tricky part. You know that some verbs are transitive, which means they have a direct object. When such verbs appear as phrasal verbs, an object can either separate the phrase or follow it. Here's an example.
I decided to throw out my old jeans. I decided to throw my old jeans out.
Both of these sentences are correct. The object of the phrasal verb throw out is jeans. You can use a pronoun instead of jeans and ask,
"Are you sure you want to throw them out?"
However, you cannot ask,
"Are you sure you want to throw out them?"
Here, the pronoun them must appear between the verb and the particle.
In recent years, language experts began to use computers to examine a large collection, or corpus, of written and spoken language. When researchers look for phrasal verbs, they find that many deal with an activity. They also find a few verbs combine with many particles. Among the most common verbs are come, put, get, go, pick, sit, and take. These combine with the adverb particles up, out, in, on, off, and down to make up a group of very useful phrasal verbs. Now, let's look at transitive phrasal verbs. See the list at the end of the article. The verb get is part of many phrasal verbs. For example, we use get up to mean to wake oneself up or to awaken someone. For example,
my son loves to sleep late. I got him up on time to catch the bus this morning.
Remember, the pronoun has to come between the verb and the adverb. So we cannot say,
I got up him.
Notice how the Norwegian group, aha, uses a separable phrasal verb two ways in their song, Take on Me. Which one is correct in formal grammar? Singers and poets have the right to use language as they please. For Learning English Everyday Grammar, I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. We've been discussing the presidency of Thomas Jefferson. He was America's third president, elected in 1800. In our last program, we talked about the dispute between Jefferson and the Chief Justice of the United States. Jefferson believed the Constitution gave Congress the right to decide the country's laws. But Chief Justice John Marshall believed the Supreme Court had the final say. The two men's beliefs were tested in a case called Marbury versus Madison. John Marshall's arguments won. He wrote a decision saying the Supreme Court had the power to rule on the laws that Congress passed. The Supreme Court did not act on that power during Jefferson's administration. But John Marshall's decision did help establish the role of the Supreme Court in the American government. The Marbury versus Madison case is one of the important legacies of Jefferson's presidency. But historian Joseph Ellis says it was not the only one.
The major achievement of Jefferson's presidency is the Louisiana Purchase, which is a lot of luck, as well as his willingness to take advantage of the luck.
The story of the Louisiana Purchase begins with France and Spain. The two European countries wanted to limit the power of the United States. So in 1800, Spain and France entered into a secret treaty. In the treaty, Spain gave France control of a large area in North America called the Louisiana Territory. The Louisiana Territory stretched north to south from the Gulf of Mexico to Canada, and it stretched east to west from the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains. The area was important not only for its large size, it also included some valuable navigation features, including where the Mississippi River opened into the Gulf of Mexico. Napoleon Bonaparte ruled France at that time. Jefferson did not want Napoleon in North America. He felt the French presence was a threat to the peace of the United States. He decided to try to buy parts of the Louisiana Territory, especially around the mouth of the Mississippi River near the city of New Orleans. Jefferson sent James Monroe to Paris as a special negotiator, but Monroe never had a chance to offer the American position. Napoleon had decided to sell everything to the Americans. He told his finance minister to give up Louisiana, all of it. Napoleon needed money for a war with Britain. James Monroe was happy to negotiate the purchase of Louisiana. They agreed on a price of 80 million francs for all the land drained by the Great Mississippi River and all its many streams. The Louisiana Purchase nearly doubled the size of the United States at that time. It included the present-day states of Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, and Nebraska. It stretched into parts of Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, and Louisiana. The Louisiana Purchase also opened the Mississippi River to American commerce and travel. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says that as a result of this access, the Louisiana Purchase fueled the country's economic expansion in the 19th century. And Mr. O'Shaughnessy says the Louisiana Purchase created more opportunities for Americans to own land.
It was very important to Jefferson because he really wanted every free member of society to be able to own land. He regarded land ownership as, in many ways, essential to someone's independence and their ability, therefore, to participate in a republican government.
But both Mr. O'Shaughnessy and historian Joseph Ellis say the Louisiana Purchase went against Jefferson's beliefs about central government. Joseph Ellis says that in many ways, Jefferson's presidency aimed to make the federal government almost invisible and to limit the president's power.
And the Louisiana Purchase is the most authoritative executive action in American presidential history. One president decides to buy the Midwest, and he does it unilaterally.
Historians say the Louisiana Purchase is one example of Jefferson's contradictory character, in which he says one thing but does another. Andrew O'Shaughnessy adds that Jefferson made trade-offs. When he bought Louisiana, Jefferson used presidential power in a way that was not specifically permitted by the Constitution. But Mr. O'Shaughnessy says Jefferson was also looking to the higher good. In the case of the Louisiana Purchase, the good of improving the country's political health. Federalists in the early 1800s also questioned Jefferson's decision to buy Louisiana. They feared it would weaken the power of the states of the Northeast. Federalist leaders made a plan to form a new government of those states. But to succeed, they needed the state of New York. Their plan for a new government led to another memorable episode in American history. Aaron Burr was vice president during Thomas Jefferson's first term. Burr became a candidate for New York governor. The Federalists believed Burr would win the election, become governor, and support their plan. But Federalist leader Alexander Hamilton did not trust Burr. The two had been enemies for a long time. Hamilton made some strong statements against Burr during the election campaign in New York. The comments later appeared in several newspapers. Burr lost the New York election. The Federalist plan for a new government of northeastern states died. New York historian Valerie Paley says Burr heard about Hamilton's strong comments. He was offended.
He called him something like despicable. It hinged on one word, and a word as simple as despicable.
Burr asked Hamilton to admit or deny the comments. Hamilton refused. The two men exchanged more notes. Burr was not satisfied with Hamilton's answers. He believed Hamilton had attacked his honor. Burr demanded a duel. A duel is a fight, usually with guns. Valerie Paley says in those days, gentlemen often used duels to settle rivalries and defend their honor.
So it wasn't so much these men dueled to kill. They would purposely miss their shots, and then the air would be cleared.
Hamilton opposed duels, yet he agreed to fight Burr on July 11th, 1804. The two men met at Weehawken, New Jersey, just across the Hudson River from New York City. The duel would take place by the water's edge at the bottom of a high rock wall. The guns were loaded. Burr and Hamilton took their places. One of Hamilton's friends explained the rules. "Are you ready, gentlemen?" he asked. Both answered yes. There was a moment of silence. He gave the signal. Burr and Hamilton raised their guns. Two shots split the air. Hamilton raised up on his toes,
then fell to the ground. Burr remained standing. He looked at Hamilton with regret, then left. Hamilton died the next day. He was not yet 50. Valerie Paley says Hamilton's story is almost like a television or newspaper drama.
He was extremely attractive, and he had such a romantic story. Here he is, the immigrant boy from the West Indies, made good, comes to New York, goes to King's College, becomes a sort of a self-taught lawyer, becomes aide-de-camp to Washington, all sorts of extraordinary things, marries so well, and also has this vision of what modern America might become, and in many ways was able to implement at least an early bit of that vision before his death.
Hamilton had made a big impact on the United States. He had created a national bank and influenced many government policies. Newspapers throughout the nation reported his death. Most people accepted the news calmly. To them, it was simply the sad end to an old private dispute. In the months after Hamilton's death, the nation prepared for the next presidential election. Once again, the Republican Party chose Thomas Jefferson as its candidate for president. But the Republicans refused to support Aaron Burr for vice president again. Instead, they chose George Clinton. Clinton had served as governor of New York 7 times. The Federalist Party chose Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina as its candidate for president. It chose Rufus King of New York to be its vice presidential candidate. The campaign was quiet. In those days, candidates did not make many speeches. Republican pamphlets told of the progress made during the past 4 years. The former Federalist administration raised taxes, they said. Jefferson ended many of the taxes. The Federalists borrowed millions of dollars. Jefferson borrowed none. And Jefferson got the Louisiana Territory without going to war. The Federalists could not dispute these facts. They expected that Jefferson would be reelected, but they were sure their candidate would get as many as 40 electoral votes. The results shocked the Federalists. Jefferson received 162 electoral votes. Pinckney received just 14. One man tried to explain the meaning of Jefferson's great victory. He was John Quincy Adams, son of former President John Adams. President Adams had been a firm Federalist. This is what his son said. "The power of Jefferson's administration rests on a strong majority of the American people. The president has great popular support. His re-election shows that the experiment of the Federalists has failed. It never can and never will be brought to life again. To try to bring it back would be foolish. It would be like trying to put life into a body that has been buried for years." After the election of 1804, only 7 Federalists remained in the United States Senate. Only 25 remained in the House of Representatives. Thomas Jefferson would be president for another 4 years.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.